Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Monday morning. So if you missed George Stephanopoulos over the weekend on Meet the Press, then you might have missed what he did with my Republican governor named Chris Sununu. I've referred to Chris Sununu as nothing more than an affable political windsock, that he has no real integrity, he has no direction, and that he will change on a dime. And yet he became the darling of the sort of more progressive liberal media because it appeared that he was pro-democracy and anti-Trump. And I had my finger down my throat going, no, he's not. So let me share with you what happened with George Stephanopoulos over the weekend, because I'm going to quote a little bit of me, a teeny tiny bit of another individual, Norm Ornstein, who also commented, but then I'm going to sort of read what Heather Cox Richardson wrote about him because it is brilliant and it's also historical, which I think is so important. And this is a place where you learn. So it's not just an opinion. You need to put it into historical perspective. So I wrote the following after watching Sununu's performance on Meet the Press. And I wrote, it's tough being a political prostitute for Trump. Watch Sununu turn a trick on ABC. Stormy Daniels is a woman of integrity, but Chris is a low-life political windsock who can't be trusted with anything. Watch him twist himself into knots and coming out looking like a frightened dip. You know what the word was. And so I posted that and someone said, oh my God, Arnie, you should read what Norm Ornstein said. Norm Ornstein wrote the following. Chris Sununu said he would support Trump even if he was convicted. Chris Sununu is a pathetic excuse for an American. He would sell out his country and the Constitution. What a disgrace. Now that's Norm being a little more political, and then there's Arnie being a little really angry. But what I need to do, and I have to ask my first guest for a little bit of forgiveness, but Heather Cox Richardson, everybody follows. She's just remarkable. And she's a historian. And by the way, her brother lives in New Hampshire. So I just let you know that it's like family ties here. And at least 15 people sent me her piece this morning about Chris Sununu. And it's fairly brief and I want to read it. I will edit it slightly, but I think it's important that you hear it because she does give it an important context. Today on ABC's This Week, host George Stephanopoulos asked New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu about his recent switch from supporting former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley for the Republican presidential nomination to supporting former President Trump. Quote, just to sum it up, Stephanopoulos said, you support Trump for president, even if he's convicted in the classified documents case? You support him for president, even though you believe he contributed to an insurrection? You support him for president, even though you believe he's lying about the last election? You support him for president, even if he's convicted in the Manhattan case? I just want to say that the answer to that is yes. Am I correct? And Sununu answered, yeah, me and 51% of America. Aside from its overstatement of Trump's national support, Sununu's answer illustrates the triumph of politics over principle. Earlier in the interview, Sununu explained that he could swallow all of Trump's negatives because he wanted a Republican administration. This, he says, is about politics. Sununu is part of the Republican faction that focuses on cutting taxes and slashing regulations. Trump has promised further tax cuts, while Biden has said he will raise taxes on the very wealthy and on corporations to make sure the nation does not have to cut Social Security benefits and Medicare. Republicans have suggested they will make these cuts to balance the budget, although at least 90% of the current budget deficit is not due to any emergency from COVID, but guess what? From tax cuts from Bush and Trump. Sununu may be embracing Trump for his fiscal policies, but there is possibly another dynamic at play in the shift of Republican leaders behind Trump. As Thomas Edsel outlined in the New York Times on April 10th in a piece about donors, they appear to be afraid of retaliation if they don't join his team. Certainly, he has worked to instill that fear, warning in January that anyone who contributed to Haley's campaign, from this moment forth, says Trump, will be permanently barred from the MAGA camp. We don't want them. We will not accept them. Trump has been very clear that he intends to use the power of the state to crush those who he feels have been insufficiently supportive of him. There is every reason to take him at his word, as he tried to do exactly that during his presidency. He, in fact, used the Internal Revenue Service to arrest former FBI Director James Comey, who refused to kill the investigation into ties between Trump's 26 campaign and the Russian operatives, as Trump demanded. And of course, Andrew McCabe, who took over as acting FBI director after Trump fired Comey. He demanded investigations, and he goes through all these things that Trump has demanded. And then, of course, there was the wonderful historical irony that the Gerald Ford Association actually was going to give him an award. And people are like, what? What? And one of the members of the Gerald Ford board had to quit going, what are you doing? As Princeton sociology professor Kim Lane Schleps told Edsel, those still operating under the impression that they will curry favor with a dictator are painfully unaware of how dictators actually operate. Like Russia's Putin or Hungary's Orban, if he is returned to power, Trump will use the power of the state to squeeze the wealthy as well as political opponents, threatening them with investigations, audits, regulation, even criminal charges, unless they do as they are told. But Sununu's cynical announcement that he would destroy American democracy if it meant his party could stay in power is not only a misguided approach to trying to appease a dictator, it is a profound rejection of the meaning of American democracy that we all created equal and have a right to say in our government. Throughout our history, Americans had found those principles so fundamental to human self-determination that they have given their ultimate lives for this. It's hard to miss that Sununu's statement fell on the anniversary of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, who stood at the cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, where those who had died to defend the United States in July 1863 were buried, and asked his fellow Americans to rededicate themselves to the great task remaining before us, that from those honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave their last full measure of devotion, that we were highly resolved that these dead shall not have died in vain, that the nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that the freedom of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. Sununu chooses to seek it perish. Oh my God. Anyway, thank you. And he's my governor. I apologize. Joining us right now is from an article that I read at theconversation.com. And as many of you know, I go to theconversation.com a lot. Sarah Patterson is a research investigator at the Survey Research Center at the Institute of Social Research at the University of Michigan. And she wrote a piece, and it grabbed me, Sarah, for two reasons. One, it mentioned Michigan. And two, it mentioned caregiving. And both of these things trigger something very different in me. The title of the piece was Michigan Governor Whitmer Proposes a Caregiver Tax Credit, an idea many Americans support. As the population of older adults in the U.S. grows, more people need care. Mm-hmm. So let me start by telling you why it triggered two things. One, I had just been on the air talking about how Democrats should approach the election after 2024. And that is, if they are given the power, if they have the political capital, they should damn use it. And that means they should look at things like daycare. They should look at things like childcare. They should raise the minimum wage. They should look at student debt. All the things that we know are that are harming the economy, harming our future, is wildly supported by the vast majority of Americans. And they should not only talk about it, they should write the policy, they should pass it, and Joe Biden should sign it. That's what I've been talking about. Don't waste your political capital, which is why I'm going to genuflect to your governor, Gretchen Whitmer, because Gretchen Whitmer has the power. She has the support of the legislature, and she's not saying, well, thank you so much and goodbye, folks. She is actually taking that power and saying, how do we now frame policy that will respond to the yawning needs of my constituents? And I am in awe of that, okay? Because it's something I've always believed. What's the point of getting elected with political capital and not using it? You know, you're not there to be permanent. You're there to do something positive. And then the whole idea of caregiving was another thing that I thought was so important, because as we all know, we have an aging demographic. Mm-hmm. And not only do we have an aging demographic, but combine that with the lowest unemployment numbers you could possibly imagine and no ability to have an immigration policy. Mm-hmm. So then the question is, if you have a problem in a nursing home, or if you need some home care, or if you're, where the hell are you going to find the people to help you? Mm-hmm. So if it turns out you can't find people, then what is your case of last resort is that you will suddenly realize you have to take care of them, you know, because it's your parent or it's your brother or it's whatever. But the problem is, how can you possibly take time out from work, lose that income, lose the support that you get from income, and suddenly be responsible for someone 24/7. Not only is it challenging, as you know, Sarah, but financially, how do you do it? How do you do it? So let me welcome you to the program and then sort of talk to us a little bit about your article, because it isn't just about Gretchen. It really does sort of look at all the inputs into the challenges of caregiving and saying this is just a first step in what we need to do.
Great. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the invitation to come speak with you, Arnie. I'm a family demographer and sociologist by training, right? So I'm really thinking about this from the population perspective. And as you mentioned, I mean, every day since I think 2011, there's 10,000 people turning 65 or older, right? So this is an issue that is here, that is now, you know, the aging of the population is not something in the future. Like, we've been doing this since 2011. And so I think it's important for us to think about how we support families in their caregiving for older family members specifically. So that's really where my research focuses on, is on caregiving for older adults. And as you said, it's, you know, people are often not just balancing one or two things. They might have their own children under age 18 that they're also caregiving for. They might be working, you know, like you mentioned, they might have to work, right? It's not like they're doing that because they, you know, have a choice. Like, they might have to go to work and then be balancing elder care. And I think, you know, in our article, we really wanted to talk about elder care specifically because that's sort of the, I would say, one of the aims of Governor Whitmer's tax credit is for elder care specifically. But I think it's important to keep in mind that elder care looks different than child care, right? So like child care, there are child care agencies. You can send them to school, things like that. Whereas with elder care, the options are potentially more limited, as you were mentioning. So you might have to put them in an institution like a nursing home. Adult daycare is potentially an option, but not a widely available option. So often it does default to family members to provide this care. And we know that estimates are showing between 38 and 53 million Americans are providing this kind of care to a family member. And the reason those estimates vary is because the definition can change, right? You were mentioning your family member. I'd be curious, you know, one of the things we find is that it's hard to define caregivers because often people and family specifically don't call themselves caregivers.
Yes, exactly.
Right? They say, I'm just being a daughter. What do you mean? Like, this is my, what I feel like I should do for my family. So it's often hard to capture family caregivers because they might not see themselves as one. But yeah.
No, stories are so important. So I mentioned that I became the guardian for my aunt, and I literally dropped out of sight for 2.5 years. I mean, right. She was incontinent, she was aging, she couldn't feed herself. I had never done this before. Mm-hmm. Okay. So here I was, this former politician, I'd been out there giving speeches, and suddenly I am now in my house all the time because you can't leave because these people are fragile. All right?
Right.
And so suddenly you're learning, oh my God, I've got to wipe their butt. I've got to bathe them. I have to give them medication. All these skills that you basically didn't think you had. Mm-hmm. I mean, wiping taking care of an adult is not like taking care of a 2-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to tell you right now. So it's also very different. But the idea of caregiving is so interesting because I'm going to go back to the sandwich concept you were talking about,
mm-hmm.
where you're caring for children and you're caring for an older adult. So my Norwegian grandmother lived by herself in Brooklyn. My father realized she was in her 80s, and my father kept insisting that he put her into a nursing home. He didn't want to take her care of her. He wanted to put her into a nursing home. My grandmother was a very difficult person, and there was no way she was going to go to a nursing home. And I kept calling her saying, Grandma, it's okay. You can come live with me. No, I had 2 and 3-year-olds, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, but no, Dad's wrong. You're not going to a nursing home. You're going to come and live with me, all right? And she kept insisting no, not because she didn't want to live with me, but she didn't want to be a burden, and you understand that. So it's a Tuesday night, and I get a phone call from my Norwegian grandmother, and she says, I'm ready to come. And I'm like, oh, I was so excited. Mm-hmm. I said, we'll be down this weekend. We'll pick you up. I'll call Dad, not to worry about it. Wednesday morning, they find her dead at her kitchen table, eating her fish balls. And I realized that on Tuesday night, she called to tell me she was coming, but she came the only way she could come, was that she wanted me to know, I love you, I want to be with you, and then she dies the next morning. I will never forget that as long as I live.
Mm-hmm.
And then fast forward, I end up caring for my aunt, and then my husband, who ends up having stage 4 cancer, I end up caring for him. But there was no financial help for that. Right. Nobody came to my aid. Nobody paid for respite care. Nobody did anything. Like somehow I should just assume because we have a DNA connection that I can handle all this. Mm-hmm. But in the end, not only was it very hard for me, but I could have just said, you know, it's not my job. They're, you know, they're a separate citizen. Let them go on Medicaid and then all of you would pay and it would be more costly and probably less healthy. So how do we start really having this conversation? We know it's happening. It's happening at a faster rate. We know we're aging. We know that people are actually less healthy in America than they are in other places. So that means that the kind of care they need, they're going to need even sooner. Why can't we come to Jesus on this and have a conversation that's real? Because it's only going to get worse.
Right. Well, I think an important point in relation to the story that you shared is that older adults themselves often have different preferences than right. perhaps the family members or other people. So actually, my colleague Adriana Reyes and I, who had written this piece in The Conversation, also did a study about attitudes towards co-residents. So the General Social Survey is this really big national study of attitudes in America, and they have looked at whether people feel like an older adult in need of care should move in with their adult children. And they've looked at this over time. And what we found is that older adults feel differently, right? They are not as supportive of this as perhaps younger adults are, working age adults are. And so exactly what your story was saying is right. like sometimes people don't prefer to have that as an option, right? They don't want to put a they don't want to make their family take up on all these responsibility. And I think that that's something we have to balance and kind of the solutions that we propose. And kind of in relation to the tax credit, as you were mentioning, the financial cost of caregiving is huge, right? It can vary from a couple thousand dollars a year up to $100,000 a year. This morning, I just looked up the cost of a nursing home in Michigan, and it's $113,000 a year, right? That is just such a huge number. At least for me, I can't fathom that number on an annual basis. So like you said, I feel like there's both these sort of emotional and social needs that go into caregiving, but there's also just the financial cost that it can put on families to provide that care. And one of the nice things about the tax credits is that it can be used, depending on how the legislation gets written, it can be used for medical expenses, because that is one of the bigger costs in elder care, is that we're really relying on families to provide at-home medical care, which is quite wild if you think about it, right? Like, right. But family members are being trained oftentimes, or sometimes they need more training on this, but that can be a cost that they have to put into consideration.
Well, let me give you a number that I posted on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I wrote, as the U.S. ages, it's time to have a come to Jesus conversation about how the hell do we handle this? As I mentioned to you, I stayed home for nearly 3 years caring for my aunt. Check out these numbers. These are the numbers from your article, Sarah. Thank mm-hmm. you so much. The total impact of caregiving, including costs such as lost wages, the impact on the caregiver's health. Yes, yes, yes. Nobody ever talks about that. Mm-hmm. Puts the personal expense of caring for a loved one at roughly $90,000 a year. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds astronomical, because a lot of people saying, well, my lost wages were only 45. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no. You can't just look at what you have lost in the mm-hmm. way of wages. You have to look at all the other sort of financial responsibilities that you are now going to be required to take on mm-hmm. to care for this person. And I think people don't do the math. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just the wages that you lose. It's all the other things. And to see that number of $90,000, you almost want to buy a billboard, you know, and you want to say to both the governors in this country, as well as the feds, how are you helping us out? We're not invisible. And there are going to be enormous both financial consequences and emotional consequences if you don't address this and address this soon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think this is why, caregiving in general, all types of caregiving, is often called invisible, right? We don't really truly know the full cost to caregivers, but studies can try to help estimate that. But as you said, there's emotional, social, you know, you were saying you were at home for years, right? So yes. What was the impact on your social well-being? And then that social well-being translates to your mental well-being and your physical health, right? So we know that all of these things are interconnected. So it's important to think about it holistically.
Well, and so I'm going to go back to both having children and then taking care of an older adult. So a lot of women are trying to figure out, is there a way for them to opt out so they could stay home with their kids? Okay, that's a good idea. They're going to give up that income, but they're giving up more than income. They're giving up being present in the workforce and having an up-to-date portfolio. So all of a sudden, when you leave and then 4 years later, you go back into the workforce, you think it's like a switch. You just show up. Well, things have changed in the workforce. Technology has changed, all these things. So you have dulled skill sets and you're not as prepared to enter the workforce. Plus, what have you done for your retirement package? Because all of a sudden now, instead of having 25 years or 30 years ready to retire, you've lost those years. Think about those costs. I mean, that's another thing that happens. So if I am caregiving for an older adult and I drop out for 3 or 4 years, the consequences are so much more than just what happens in that year. You've impacted your retirement. You've impacted your skills. And nobody ever does all the math. And that's really what bothers me, Sarah, is I suspect even when you got to that 90,000, you didn't look at, well, what did I lose in the way of retirement? Mm-hmm. What did I lose there? Because again, I will have lost. What did I lose in going up the corporate ladder? Because all of a sudden I dropped out, you know, and sure enough, I've lost advancement. So there are so many ways to do this. If you had to look around the world at countries that are more prepared to address this aging demographic, is there a place that you would point to?
Arnie, I'm a pessimist when it comes to this. I don't think any of us are really prepared for this. But I think the tax credit is one place to start, because I think that it does provide some support for family caregivers. And I think it's also an important signal to them that they're seen, right? That it's right. Not so invisible that we do see what they're doing and providing for older family members, citizens, and other people, right?
What about providing wages? I feel like I want to do a let's make a deal. I can put them in Medicaid and you can pay this or you can pay me this. Which one would you prefer? Give them an option, you know, because and then say, well, if I'm not going to encourage this like Medicaid option in a nursing home, then I think there has to be an option out which will save you some money, perhaps provide the kind of emotional support that's needed, but also recognize that I have value. Mm-hmm. My time has value. So let's pay it, because you pay one way or you pay the other, but one is invisible and the other comes out of the federal coffers or the state coffers. But now let's sort of cut the deal in half, like Solomon and the baby.
Yeah. So that's interesting, because paid leave, right, has been another conversation that's come up in relation to family caregivers. But what you find is, like, at least in public support, that tax credits really get a lot of support. When you ask people if they would prefer a tax credit to things like paid leave or even unpaid leave, the tax credits really rise to the top in terms of what people are willing to support. AARP did a study recently of voters age 50 and older, and they found that 8 in 10 of those people would support a $5,000 annual tax credit, caregiver tax credit. So again, I think in terms of the policy solutions right now, at least, the tax credits really do get a lot of support, which I think makes that, you know, from a public perspective, easier to sort of move along.
It is easy until you become the caregiver. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly $5,000 is a joke. Mm-hmm. I mean, no offense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of like until you get sick, you don't really care whether it's the Affordable Care Act. And then you get sick and you went, oh my God. All right. It's like, that's part of our problem, is that we don't sort of have this sense of whether it's generational ethics or we don't anticipate the future. We think we'll always be healthy. We think we'll never have to care for a parent. We'll think about all these things. And this is a conversation I have with my children all the time about how, what is going to be their responsibility. And I have it now. All right. And yet too many of us don't have it. And while I love the idea of a credit is a tiny, tiny drop in the bucket with what we're expecting folks to do. Now, before I let you go, Sarah, since you're a demographer, we are seeing for the first time people dying younger in America. Okay, and people are saying, well, look, they're dying younger. We're not going to need as many. But in a lot of ways, part of the reason they're dying younger also is, I suspect they're also dying a little bit sicker. And so as we look at this changing demographic, we have to look at, and especially in certain populations, people are going to be aging faster, getting sicker faster, because they didn't have the kind of healthcare supports. And the people that need the support the most are those that are the most invisible. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's not going to be in white, wealthy New Hampshire that you're going to see a huge need, but it might probably be in Arkansas and Alabama, and they'll get nothing unless the feds step in. Am I right?
Yeah, I'm not, you know, there is definitely regional variation in that aspect. And I think something that's important to keep in mind is that, at least in relation to the most recent impact of COVID-19 in terms of the life
Right.
course being shortened. We don't really know the true impact and what that will look like. So I think that that's why it's important for demographers, to sort of give myself a boost. Yeah, it's important for us to keep track of those trends so that we can understand where there is the regional variation for
Absolutely.
legislators to pay attention to.
Well, thank you very much. Sarah Patterson is a research investigator at the Survey Research Center at the Institute of Social Research at the University of Michigan. She wrote a piece at The Conversation, Michigan Governor Whitmer proposes a caregiver tax credit. Love you, Michigan. An idea many Americans support as the population of older adults in the U.S. grows and more people need care. Now let's see if it passes. Thank you so much for doing this, Sarah. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stick around, folks. We'll be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. By now, everyone is aware of the Iranian missile and drone attack against Israel, and that fortunately, it seems like casualties were extremely low because most of those missiles were destroyed before they were able to harm anyone in Israel. President Biden played an instrumental role in that by helping Israel defend itself, but is trying to work with Israel to get them not to retaliate further and to try to de-escalate this conflict. In plain English, Joe Biden is trying to prevent a major regional war into which the United States could be dragged. That's probably a good idea. Meanwhile, over at CNN, one of their headlines is John Bolton says Biden's failure, by Biden urging Israel not to retaliate, is an embarrassment. Now, John Bolton is entitled to his opinion, as are all of us, but it is extremely irresponsible for a media outlet to just say John Bolton says this without remarking that John Bolton was one of the major architects and advocates for the Iraq War, which is now broadly understood to have been a mistake. There's never been an opportunity to go to war that John Bolton didn't like, and more often than not, he's been very, very wrong. And to not say that, presenting as if he's just some expert because he was a national security advisor to about a year for Donald Trump, of all people, is to somehow create a false equivalency between Biden and John Bolton. And this is what is so wrong with the media. Every now and then, you just have to tell the truth. And the truth here is that John Bolton is a warmonger who has as much business weighing in on serious matters of state as I do of filling in at first base for the Yankees because Anthony Rizzo is in a slump. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
Here's how the voting system works. Or doesn't. I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. In November 2026, Crystal Mason, thinking she was doing her civic duty, went to the polls to cast her vote. But her name was not on the voting roll, so Ms. Mason did what typically happens. She cast a provisional ballot. It turns out that Ms. Mason was not eligible to cast a real ballot because she was on federal supervised release. That's not a voting disqualification in many states, but it is in Texas, where she and her three children lived. Everyone agrees Ms. Mason didn't know that. But Texas prosecutors didn't care at all. They maintained lack of criminal intent was irrelevant. All that matters was that she illegally cast a provisional ballot, and she was convicted of voter fraud and sentenced to 5 years. 5 years for casting a provisional ballot that was never counted. Finally, in April 2024, a Texas court rejected that theory and acquitted her. So, all's well that ends well? Not really. First, Ms. Mason had to live through years and years with a 5-year prison sentence hanging over her head. Second, the case sadly may teach people who have had a brush with the law to not risk trying to register and vote. The stakes are too high. That's wrong. But fortunately, Ms. Mason has taught us another lesson about fortitude and the importance of fighting for your rights. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU because freedom can't protect itself.
It's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race, when you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. when it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity, when you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells, when you see approaching the future this foretells, when they're coming for your neighbors, when they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away, when you know where they keep the buses, you've been to the parking lot, perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know what we do? We record on Monday morning. We admire Mark Stern a lot. I talk about him a lot. He's a senior reporter at Slate.com. He's written a number of pieces, and originally I was going to go to him to talk about the Arizona zombie abortion ban, which is back, and then I saw that he wrote about the Stormy Daniels prosecution. I thought, oh my God, that's happening on Monday, and then I reread his piece about Arizona. Before we talk about what's happening in New York in the courtroom, I wanted to talk about Arizona because I didn't quite understand it to the depth of explanation that Mark Stern and Dahlia Lithwick were able to provide. It made me realize you need to understand this because it will explain a lot about how the Supreme Court in Arizona made its choice. It will also put the concept of age into perspective. And you will understand that by the end of our conversation about Mark's fabulous piece, Arizona's Zombie Abortion Ban is Back. It's every state's future if Trump wins. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Stern.
Thank you so much, Arnie. Happy to be here as always.
So just to let you know, we've been covering Project 2025 in incredible detail on this show. Literally. I mean, literally go through it almost every day. I do a little nugget about it. I'm not doing it today because of something Chris Sununu did over the weekend. In a lot of ways, whatever Trump says, ignore. What you need to understand is what's in Project 2025. And so when you talk about what's going on with it, it's every state's future, they need to understand it is. It is. So walk us through exactly about the Arizona Supreme Court ruling, which with its total abortion ban, because everyone was like, what the hell? They're going back to a law from 1864. Arizona wasn't even a freaking state. It was a territory. How do you go back to that and reference that in 2024, but you explain it, and I want my audience to hear the explanation.
Yeah, so I guess the first point that is really kind of crucial to understanding this and so much else the anti-abortion movement's trying to do right now after Roe has fallen is to just remember that when a court blocks a law, it doesn't erase that law from the books, right? The law is still on the books, it's just unenforceable. And that means that if the court decisions that had blocked the law are overturned, then that law can spring back to life. And that's what we call in the biz a zombie law. It's like it was dead, we thought it was gone, and then it sprung back to life. And this Arizona statute is the quintessential example of a zombie law because it was passed in 1864, was written by a serial child predator, by the way. This history came out shortly after our piece. It was written by a man who had a passion for raping children, which was more socially acceptable at the time. He and his white male colleagues, because women weren't allowed to vote, women weren't allowed to hold office, they enacted this law as part of the territorial code of Arizona during the Civil War. So this is pre-Appomattox, right? This is 1864, to deprive women of any autonomy, right? To deprive them of the ability to terminate an unwanted pregnancy. It stays on the books for decades, for centuries now, almost 160 years. But for modern history, it's been totally defanged, right? Because under Roe v. Wade, laws like this were set aside. They couldn't be enforced. They were all sort of, you know, just on ice. And we assumed, many of us, that they would be on ice forever. The Arizona legislature actually came back and issued a less stringent abortion law that bans the procedure after 15 weeks, which included language that I think and a lot of people thought had effectively repealed previous legislation, including this law. But after Roe fell, the Arizona Supreme Court decided to take up this law and to do whatever kind of Frankenstein magic it needed to do to channel legal lightning and bring it back to life, and said, surprise, the legislature hasn't repealed this law. The courts haven't permanently erased this law. It's still on the book, and we are going to enforce it as it is written, which means that if, according to this law in Arizona, there are no legal abortions, even in the case of rape, in the case of incest, in the case of health of the mother, only in the case of the mother's imminent death. And this is what we've seen in places like Texas, right, where women have to wait until they're hemorrhaging and bleeding out before they can terminate a failing pregnancy. And what I think is so important to remember is that this was the result of a state Supreme Court that was passed by Republicans. You know, we hear all the time, oh, Democrats are going to pack the court. You know, they're going to add justices and destroy democracy. Well, Democrats were sort of musing about expanding the U.S. Supreme Court. Republicans just went and expanded the Arizona Supreme Court with very little controversy or debate. There was a liberal majority. Arizona Republicans said, we don't like that. So they added two seats and flipped it to a conservative supermajority. And it was that conservative supermajority that revived the Arizona abortion ban last week. And, you know, it was all appointees of former Governor Doug Ducey who did it. This was a pure kind of Republican scheme. Democrats in the legislature have come in and they're trying to repeal it now. The Republicans won't let them. And so this is a great example of, you know, why court packing is so powerful in the hands of Republicans. It has revived a law that for 160 years we all thought was dead.
Okay, so let me mirror back what I'm hearing from you because I want my audience to process this. So we have this 1864 law that bans abortion. Then we have the 15-week abortion ban, but that was passed when? Like 20 years ago, 15? Like within the
last few years.
Last few years, okay? So what happens is Dobbs then gets passed, and Dobbs then says there is no protection for abortion, at least federally, from Roe v. Wade. So you have these, what they claim are two dueling pieces of legislation, the 1864 one from the Arizona Territory and the one that passed with the 15-week ban in most recent terms. And you're telling me that when they passed the 15-week ban, was there a discussion on the floor about 1864? Is there something in the legislative record that says that when they were passing this, they were aware of 1864, and that although they may have been inartful in their language, the assumption was this would overturn 1864 and the 15-week ban would then go in place? Or the problem was that they were so void for vagueness that it looks like these two laws are conflicting, but because of the passage of Dobbs, the one that takes the precedent is the 1864 one, which trumps the 15-week one. Am I reading this correctly?
So that's basically right. I'll just say they didn't specifically talk about the 1864 law, to my knowledge, but they talked about the fact that there were previous abortion laws on the books, right? They came to this understanding that it was not a blank page. And they said, what we are going to do is enact a new law that, and you can read this in the text of the law. I mean, it seems to sweep aside what came before it. And it says, this is now the law. It's a 15-week ban. And I think in doing so, that cut in both directions, right? It meant, well, if there are any more pro-choice laws, those are overturned. And if there are any more anti-choice laws, those are overturned. This is now the state of the law in Arizona. I mean, that is how the legislature understood it. That is what I think is written in the text. And that is what the Arizona Supreme Court refused to acknowledge in this decision. What the court instead said was, well, the legislature passed a 15-week ban because at that point, Roe versus Wade was still on the book.
Right.
And they only did it because they thought they were pushing the limits of Roe versus Wade. Then Roe versus Wade was overturned. We should assume that the legislature knew when enacting the 15-week ban that the 1864 ban was still on the books and that they wanted it to be sprung back into life, despite language in the statute that says this is now the governing law of abortion in Arizona. And I can't think of a better word to call that than judicial activism. I mean, that is judicial activism, pure and simple, because it is taking a law that the legislature evidently wanted to set aside and putting it back into force, much like Trump wants to do with the Comstock Act, which we'll talk about, and saying, basically, you know, we're going to override the legislature's determinations. We've decided that this is how the law should be, a total ban. You know, these judges were put on that court to do precisely this. If it hadn't been done this way, it might have been done another way, fetal personhood, whatever, right? But they said, you know, we're here, we are going to enact this total ban, and now it's in the hands of Arizona voters whether they want to keep it or not.
Now, my understanding is Carrie Lake has also referenced the 1864 law. So it sounds like there was a conversation even before the Arizona Supreme Court decided that it had that it preempted and over it trumped literally the 15-week ban because of the decision in Dobbs. It sounds like there was at least some political, you know, backdrop and conversation going, oh, here's the wonderful, because I think that's what Carrie Lake said. Oh, not to worry. We've got this great ban from 1864. So you see a court that is incredibly political because they're letting Carrie Lake define how they interpret the laws in Arizona. Therefore, they're able to go back and say the 1864 is still around. I mean, it sounds like hopeful thinking on the part of a lot of politicians, or especially Republican politicians like Carrie Lake, that, oh, look at this. We've got this great anti-abortion law. And the Supreme Court in Arizona said, yeah, you do. it just feels, and now of course Carrie Lake is like, oh, and she's doing the
now she's running from it, right? Now
she's saying,
oh, I didn't mean to support it, I didn't know. Because this is the dog that caught the car, you know, right, over and over again in all of these states where suddenly these bans come into effect and a lot of Republicans realize it's quite bad for them. I think that's a good description of it. It's you know, it's so dispiriting, I think, to see these zombie laws come into effect, in part because when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe, we all remember Sam Alito writing the opinion that we're returning the issue of abortion to the people and their representatives, right? The people and their elected representatives now decide abortion. But it turns out that's not who is deciding abortion in a lot of these states. Who's deciding the matter of abortion are dead white child predators from 1864. Nobody alive today or their great-great-great-grandparents voted for those people or their elected representatives, right? Nobody on the planet today has any idea what those guys were thinking and had no say over it. And so what the court effectively did was allow the dead hand of these very racist, very sexist white men to strangle reproductive freedom and democracy today. It's really, really gross. And I think even... I mean, it's just even more shocking in a sense because one of the justices in the majority in the Arizona Supreme Court pitches himself as this libertarian. He founded these libertarian think tanks. The governor, Doug Ducey, who appointed these justices, he claims to be libertarian. But when it comes to the issue of women's reproductive freedom, all of the libertarianism goes out the window. And we're back to the views of, you know, dead white men who hated women and wanted them to suffer.
My state of New Hampshire has no minimum wage on its books. So that means if there is a repeal, everyone, of the federal $7.25 minimum wage, we have none, nothing, niente in my state. So I'm thinking about what you're talking about with this 1864. We've been trying to pass a minimum wage bill in New Hampshire, and we don't have one. People keep saying, oh, the law in New Hampshire is $7.25. I said, no, that's not the law in New Hampshire. That's the federal law. That's not our law. So I keep thinking about it exists in so many places, number one. And number two, there is a message to legislators around the country. If you were going to introduce a piece of legislation, and you know that there is something currently on the books that this will basically overturn, or you better mention it specifically. You can't be vague. You can't be void. You can't make it sort of a generic assumption. You have to literally go through every single piece of legislation in your state and says, this overturns this, this overturns this, this overturns that. Because again, I don't want to give any court any kind of a license to do what this very, very activist court did, because they could sort of drive a Mack truck through anything unless you precisely identify what it is, in fact, this overturns.
So I guess I'll just add that at the end of the day, a court like this will still probably do whatever it wants. And I'll just flag for any listeners in Arizona or listeners with family in Arizona Two of the justices in this majority in Arizona are on the ballot in November. They are up for retention elections. If they lose their retention election, they will be ousted from the court. And the current governor, who is a Democrat, Katie Hobbs, will be able to replace them and restore what would basically be a 4-3 moderate majority. Not liberal by any means, but not insane like the current majority. And so, you know, I think I spend so much time in my line of work saying what you just said, right? Like, you have to go over the laws over and over again. You have to make them super clear. You have to do everything you can to leave zero gaps and zero ambiguities. But at the end of the day, a court like this one will still do whatever it wants. And so at the end of the day, if you aren't getting good people on these courts, then you are leaving your fate in the hands of just absolute, like, gonzo conservative far-right activists. And that is not a state of affairs we should settle for.
And as you talked about expanding the Arizona court, which, you know, people keep saying we should be doing with the United States Supreme Court, even though the two of these very conservative justices are up for re-election, just to remind everyone, there are seven people currently on the Arizona Supreme Court. All seven were appointed by Republicans. And I think it's important for people to know that there's like two Republican parties. There's a Republican party that's less MAGA, and then there's MAGA. So it's not like they're not all conservative. But what conservative used to mean and what MAGA conservative means now is almost on two different planets. There are seven Republicans. I mean, I want people to understand they're all appointed by Republican governors, but this is the level of extremism that now is being reflected by the appointments of some of these Republican governors. I mean, that's what's so scary.
Yeah, it was the two dissenting justices were appointed by Jan Brewer, who, God, was not by any means like a real moderate. She passed some horrible immigration laws, but at the end of the day, she wasn't a MAGA governor. You know, she was like a kind of regular old Republican. She did stuff that we hate, but she was a regular Republican. And so her justices are normal people who respect democracy. All right, and that is just, that doesn't happen anymore.
Let's sort of now evolve or devolve and go to Comstock in the Supreme Court. Because I think Comstock is a variation on exactly this theme, only this is in some ways more frightening because this would basically apply to everything. And it would apply to things like abortion pills, mifepristone, the level of potential with this return of, or not the return, but the enforcement of Comstock would be frightening.
Yes. So we're on zombie laws. Let's turn to the granddaddy of them all, right? The Comstock Act of 1873. This was a law passed by Congress for Anthony Comstock, who was a notorious sort of puritanical crusader. His number one focus was women, right? He didn't want feminist literature going through the mail. He didn't want any kind of birth control going through the mail. He certainly didn't want abortion-inducing drugs going through the mail. He didn't want women to have any control over their bodies, including their brains. And that's important to note. If you pull up the Comstock Act and read it right now, the abortion stuff is really secondary. The number one thing that he was going after was feminist literature. He didn't want women to be liberated from, you know, their plight from the in the home as unequal citizens. He wanted them to stay barefoot and pregnant, as you often say, Arnie. So this is a law that for, I mean, really basically a century has been assumed to be so narrow as to be meaningless because it's incredibly broad on the page, but the courts construed it very narrowly. And then Roe v. Wade came along and Griswold came along and the Supreme Court issued these decisions that said, no, you have a right to abortion. You have a right to birth control. You know, this law cannot possibly still be enforceable. But now the right to abortion has been overturned. And the Comstock Act, if read explicitly and without the narrowing construction that was given to it by the courts and read in like the most aggressive way, it says first that you cannot transport any abortion pills in any way, not through the mail, not through a common carrier like UPS. Basically, you cannot get abortion pills from point A to point B, that any attempt to do so is a felony offense. And then it also says that any attempt to transport equipment that would induce an abortion, anything, any physical object that could induce an abortion, that is also a felony offense. So sending, for instance, a vacuum aspirator, which is used in first trimester procedural abortions at clinics, right? They are very common. They're used for other things. But if this law is brought back to life, it would mean that you cannot make and ship that equipment to an abortion clinic without subjecting yourself and the recipient to federal charges for a felony offense. So this law is on the books right now. We all learned about it because last year, Judge Matthew Kaczmarek in Texas used the Comstock Act to ban medication abortion nationwide, right? And we all know now that Donald Trump's plan, and I know this because his top lawyer, Jonathan Mitchell, has said it in public on the record, his plan is to pretend not to support abortion bans through the campaign, to pretend to be moderate on abortion, moderately pro-choice, wanting to leave it to the states through the campaign, and then as soon as he enters office in 2025, to use the Comstock Act to impose a federal ban on medication abortion, to impose a federal ban on procedural abortions in clinics in all 50 states, to prosecute providers, to shut down any kind of company that produces this equipment or medication, and to essentially make a zero-week abortion ban the law of the land through executive action.
All right, so I have a question for you. So that includes birth control, correct? Yes, yes.
Well, okay, so the
now the reason I have to ask this question, because I keep thinking about, can you send condoms through the mail? So because the only reason why you put that glove on is for you not to have your sperm go into it. So I'm just trying to, I mean, that prevents a pregnancy. Is a condom and birth control pills, are they on the same plane?
So the anti-abortion groups argue that birth control is, quote, an abortifacient because it deprives a life the opportunity to live. I'm not sure that even an aggressive reading of the law could go quite that far to birth control, but it definitely does go to mifepristone and misoprostol, which are the drugs used in medication abortion. And I think it's important to remember that these are drugs used for other things as well, right? All of these drugs have other purposes that are widely used and that are very important for women's health. And in states where abortion is currently banned, pharmacies are refusing to provide them for those purposes. There are people with, for instance, autoimmune disorders who use these drugs, people who have natural miscarriages who are prescribed these drugs to complete their miscarriages, and pharmacies won't give them to them, right? Pharmacies will not prescribe them because they say, we are afraid of getting prosecuted for prescribing these drugs, even though you only need it for this or that. Nothing to do with, you know, terminating your own pregnancy, we still won't give them to you. And that is going to be happening in all 50 states if Trump is reelected under the Comstock Act.
So I want to read your last paragraph because it was like a bingo moment for me. I just have to tell you this, Mark Joseph Stern. The next time someone tells you they really worry about abortion rights, but President Biden is just too old, please gently remind them that Joe Biden is not, in fact, 160. And I read this and I'm like, what is he talking about? And that is the age of the law that will soon be sending abortion providers to prison in Arizona if they attempt to assist a victim of rape or incest. If edgy modernity is truly your thing, be afraid of Republican judges who are at war with modernity itself. They will gladly welcome the assistance of pro-choice voters whose apathy facilitates the rollback of women's equal citizenship. And it's now abundantly clear they're not rolling back the tape to the 1970s or even to the 1920s. The project is to set your clocks back to the time when women didn't even matter enough to have a vote. And they were merely, that is such a brilliant way of looking at age. I am so grateful because Comstock is 151, the Arizona law is 160, and Joe Biden's 81. Okay, I know which one's younger. I know which one's younger. And it wasn't until you framed it that way that I was just so, so grateful. Really quickly, at some point, have the courts been asked to define what near death means?
They have. And in Texas, they have defined it to mean you absolutely need to be on the brink of some kind of either catastrophic damage to your essential organs or literally about to die. Because remember, Kate Cox had a failing pregnancy where she was told it must be terminated right now or you could face serious illness or death. And the Texas court said, not good enough. You're not close enough to death. So yeah, you have to be crashing on the table before you can get a legal abortion. And you understand why, right? In a place like Texas, the penalty for an illegal abortion is 99 years in prison. It's not just losing your license or getting suspended from a hospital. It's going to prison for the rest of your life. So yeah, they need to see a patient actually dying before they can legally terminate.
So have we had the lawsuit yet? Okay, I was basically almost dying and I had my abortion, but now I am permanently impaired. Because remember, everyone, when you are on the verge of actual death, it's not like you're 100% great and then you die. There are things that are happening within your system. Has anyone yet tried to sue a state that says you couldn't get the abortion, that they waited so long, that now you are permanently impaired? Who's paying for this?
Yeah. I mean, I can only hope that the individuals responsible for this stuff, that they are dragged into court over and over again, and that the justices and judges who are enforcing them have to face the consequences of their actions, because this is grotesque, it's violent, it's misogynistic. And we need to see more women like Kate Cox at least fighting. I know it's difficult, it's a horrible position for them to be in, but we can't just let this stuff happen in silence. The public needs to know what's going on.
Abortion zombie, Arizona zombie abortion ban is back. It's every state's future if Trump wins. Please go to slate.com and check out Dahlia Lithwick and Mark Joseph Stern's fabulous piece. And if you have any questions about the trial that begins today, you might also sort of follow Mark Joseph Stern as he sort of comes to Jesus on this and realizes, hey, you know, this is really a good case. I was a skeptic of the Stormy Daniels prosecution. I was wrong. I was with you. I followed your piece, and I am in total agreement. Thank you so much for doing this, Mr. Stern. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Arnie.
All right, ciao. This, everyone, is a Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao. You bet.